that intelligent design is an abomination. It's a representation of intellectual laziness driven by the desire to turn this country and as many other countries as possible into a theocracy. It's quite deplorable, and it is so alien to the scientific spirit of saying, of giving a non-explanation, and also, of course, which is another strand of the intelligent designer's approach to these things, misrepresenting results. It is a scientific abomination, and people who value the power of the human intellect should ensure that our children are not contaminated by this extraordinarily seductive, lazy abomination.
This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast from Watchman Fellowship Incorporated. Here is your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
The gentleman you heard at the beginning is Oxford chemist and atheist Dr. Peter Adkins, decrying the idea of intelligent design in the universe. As an atheist, Adkins believes that only science can give us the truth about the world we inhabit and investigate. And he is not alone in this regard, as the religious-like devotion to science pervades discussions in social media as well. For better or worse, I am fairly active on Twitter. I enjoy lively discussions about Christianity with skeptics and atheists. One reply that often comes up in such exchanges is that evidence for God should somehow be testable by science. Routinely, you will see many non-believers making this statement in various ways. Evidence for God, they say, should be testable, repeatable, and verifiable by means of scientific experimentation. Now, there's nothing at all wrong with someone asking for evidence for why I believe. We should be able to provide reasons for the hope that is in us with gentleness and respect, and I often try to do just that. But there are a few issues that surface very quickly in such exchanges. One is that the skeptic believes God can be tested and identified in a lab as if God were akin to carbon or helium or other such physical properties. The second problem is that the discipline of science is simply not equipped to define who God is or test for his existence. Where do you point the telescope? What should we put in the microscope slides? Would a Geiger counter suffice? What about a seismograph? Of course, God is not akin to physical objects. The Bible is clear that what has been created, what we see, the things the physical sciences investigate, have been created by what is unseen. God is love, God is spirit, God is light, and dwells in unapproachable light. The only way God can be seen by us is through the incarnate mediation of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. In Christ, God is veiled in flesh, as the hymn writer says. The popular idea that God can and should be testable by science is one aspect of what is known as scientism, the belief that science is the only pathway to true knowledge. Note the emphasis on only. It is part of what constitutes scientific naturalism. As Edward Davis and Robin Collins note, quote, "The conjunction of naturalism, the claim that nature is all there is, and hence there is no supernatural order above nature, with the claim that all objects, processes, truth, and facts about nature fall within the scope of the scientific method, end quote. Many scientists who write books for the general public do indeed espouse this view of science, but of course, the beliefs that nature is all there is, that the supernatural realm does not exist, and that science is the only path to truth are not finally statements and beliefs that can be demonstrated by science. So why do scientists and laypersons still hold to such a view? For many, it seems to provide a kind of rhetorical defeater for God's existence. They hold that if science cannot answer questions about God's existence, then the question of God's existence is fundamentally meaningless. But as philosopher J.P. Moreland points out, quote, "Very few Christians know anything about scientism, and they certainly do not understand how it is marginalizing Christianity and placing it outside the culture's plausibility structure." And statistics from the Barna Group and other opinion researchers show that scientism is causing our children and grandchildren to leave the faith in record numbers, end quote. A link to J.P. Moreland's helpful book, Scientism and Secularism, Learning to Respond to a Dangerous Idea, can be found in the notes section of this episode. There exists a dangerous myth in the minds of many today that one has to either believe in science or believe in God, and that it is impossible for any rational person to be able to believe in both. But this is completely false. Our guest this week and next on Apologetics Profile is cosmologist, researcher, and author Dr. Luke Barnes, who has seen and interacted with scientism among his scientist colleagues. Luke shares with us what scientism is, where it came from, and how Christians can and should respond to it. Luke and I have also put together a 4-page profile on this very topic. It is available for free in the link in the episode notes. Well, good afternoon or morning to you, Luke Barnes. I'm talking to you in the future like I did last time. How's Wednesday looking?
Yes, hello from Wednesday. Wednesday's looking very nice. There's a little bit of cloud, but other than that, it's a fine day here on Wednesday morning.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love talking to people in the future. It's so fun.
Yep. Well, nothing bad happens between sort of Tuesday and Wednesday, so that's nice.
That's good. That's good. I'll keep you around for future reference. Get it? Future reference.
Very good.
All right. Well, the reason we've got you on Apologetics Profile, Dr. Barnes, is because we're going to be talking about something you and I co-authored for Watchmen, a profile on scientism. And just briefly, Luke, why don't you just give us a background about this term? Because as I read it, and when you talk to people that are not Christians, a lot of people think this term scientism is just a pejorative that evangelicals have made up who hate science. And really, it's actually something much more than that. If you want to go into briefly the background of it, what is this idea of scientism?
Well, let's just say from the start, it does sound like a made-up word. So the idea is we have science, which is, you know, let's go look really hard at the natural world and see what we can find out and see if we can work out how it works and how it fits together. And we'll do that by very careful observation. We'll make sure that different people are doing observations. And if we think that there's something like a chemical reaction that happens, we'll make sure different people see the same chemical reaction when they do the same, you know, experiment. We'll write up our results and publish them to the wider community so that they can comment on that. We'll do peer review. This is the whole program of science. And that's science itself. You know, that's the thing I'm involved in as a scientist. It's a wonderful enterprise. Scientism, I'm not 100% sure of the context of where the term came from, but there are some people who basically own the term, so it's not purely a term of abuse. There are some people who will say, "Yeah, sure, I'm a scientist." You know, I well, you can't The problem with scientism is if you subscribe to scientism, the natural thing to say was that they are a scientist, but that's the someone who does science. So an advocate of scientism, I think, is what we have to say. But it's basically the idea that, very roughly, the idea is science gives us the only reliable form of knowledge. And some would take out the word reliable, basically the only form of knowledge. It's not just that, you know, science is the most secure form of knowledge. It's not like it's the best form of knowledge. Actually, someone who is, you know, someone could believe in God and be a theist and not be any sort of, you know, naturalist who thinks that only the natural world exists, and still think that, you know, science is sort of at least the most reliable form of knowledge that we have, just because it studies the most immediate things to our senses, the most, just because it's aimed so close to home, and, you know, that's the most reliable. But scientism goes beyond that and says it's the only reliable form of knowledge. And so I come across this attitude. Sometimes it's explicitly defended by people, and sometimes it's just kind of an attitude in the background. It's one of those philosophical assumptions that's just hovering around in the background of someone's worldview without really having been properly established.
Okay, so the concept of scientism is, as you expressed, something like science is the only way to know the truth about the world. Science is the best way to know the truth about the world. Different facets of that. But the interesting thing about this assumption is that science itself cannot produce it or procure it. It doesn't come from science. It's a philosophical assumption up front, correct?
Well, it's a philosophical statement. If you had a good argument for it, it would go from being a philosophical argument to sort of a philosophical, you know, knowledge, philosophical, you know, something that was firmly established by philosophy. Problem is, if you did that, then you would have learned it via philosophy and not via science, and so it would sort of shoot itself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my as much as I can piece together. I'm not a professional philosopher. I'm certainly not a historian of philosophy or anything like that. So, sort of roughly, here's how I think we got to where we are in terms of scientism. In the start of the 20th century, there's a movement amongst certain philosophers to try to make the logic of science as absolutely watertight and rigorous as possible, basically to make it as solid as the foundations of mathematics. Now, the interesting thing about that is in 1932, Kurt Gödel shows that actually the foundations of mathematics aren't quite what we thought they were, but that's another story entirely, a very interesting story.
Yes.
But so you have people like, I guess, Bertrand Russell is one of the main people here, A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R. And so that you have this school which is called something like logical positivism or verificationism. And they put forward the idea that one of the things they say is that the meaning of a claim is the meaning of that claim is precisely the steps that you would go about in order to verify that claim scientifically. So unless that claim is just sort of a matter of definition, we decide that, you know, some definition about the world, so some sort of classification of things. Whenever you try to say something about the world itself, the meaning of that sentence is precisely what you would have to do to verify that that's true. So if I say, for example, a certain pesticide will kill plants, is lethal to plants. The meaning of that is precisely that if I go and put this pesticide, I guess it wouldn't be a pesticide, wasn't it? I put this poison on a plant, the plant will wither and shrivel and die. And so there's a very close connection. But it's not just saying that we should test our ideas. It's saying literally the meaning of the sentence is the way that we test it.
Mm.
And if you have that idea, then when you go looking at, say, religious claims that God exists, and you say, all right, what experiment do I do to prove that God exists?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most theists will say, well, that's not, God is not a scientific thing, so you can't just go and measure God. Then they'll say, okay, so what that means is under this system, literally that sentence then becomes meaningless, not just false. It doesn't even rise to the level of being false. It's not even false. It's just a meaningless sentence. And so religious claims are gone. Moral claims are gone. If you say, you know, love is good or theft is bad, those are meaningless.
Mm.
There's no way to test those with an experiment. Aesthetic claims, you know, sunsets are beautiful, that one's gone. So that's logical positivism / verificationism. And we're talking here 20s, 10s, 20s, 30s, 1910s, 20s and 30s. That philosophy has a huge impact on science and is sort of taken on by a lot of scientists as the default philosophy of science. If you're a scientist, then this is your philosophy. And there's a really interesting story about how, well, the effect that this has on quantum mechanics. But that's probably too far afield. But there's a book, great book by Adam Becker called What is Real, if you want to get into that. Anyway, that gets assumed by scientists, but then meanwhile, back in the philosophy during the sort of 40s, 50s, and 60s, that whole philosophy falls apart because for a couple of reasons. Well, the most obvious is it can't verify itself.
Right.
So the statement you should only the meaning of a sentence is the empirical steps you take to verify it. That sentence has no empirical steps to verify it. So by its own rules, it's meaningless. So that's the perfect example of just shooting yourself in the foot. So that then, so you know. Verificationism, logical positivism dies in philosophy in the middle of the 20th century, but a lot of the scientists, because you know they're not, they sort of imbibed this worldview,
mm-hmm.
this particular verificationism by default, don't notice. I mean, they're not exactly watching on in philosophy to see what happens next, and so it sort of remains behind the scenes as this is the default assumption behind science. And I think what it then morphs into is nothing as precise as what, you know, Eyre and Russell are saying, the meaning of a sentence, yada, yada, yada. It just turns into the scientific method is the only way to get knowledge and everything else is just nonsense and hearsay and rubbish and beneath us, and you can't test it, so you can't prove it, and you know, and so that's how I think we get to where we are, where there's a whole bunch of scientists who are making philosophical assumptions about the world, but don't realize it's a philosophical assumption, and don't realize that it's a philosophical assumption that's dead inside of philosophy.
Yes.
So that's my oversimplified. That's how I put it together.
No, that's excellent. It's something that, I mean, if you're familiar with C.S. Lewis, it was a philosophy that he hammered against during his lifetime was the positivist verificationist conceptual ideas of epistemology, what we call the philosophy of knowledge. But yes, an accurate and excellent summary there, Luke. I think from the 20s until the 50s, it had about a 30 to 40 year lifespan as a philosophy, died a pretty nasty death internally. And then was sort of kept on life support, I think, as you say, by scientists who were not particularly curious about the philosophy, but it just kind of morphed into this idea, as you say, the scientific method is the best or the only way that we can know truth about anything. Of course, as you point out, that statement itself, that the scientific method is the best or only way to know anything, is non-scientific as well. But why do you think this took off and took hold in science? What do you think? I mean, you are a scientist. You work in this field. You've seen it. And in the paper we're talking about, you've quoted several individuals who own the term, if you will. Why do you think that this died in philosophy but found new life in the hard sciences?
Well, I think part of the answer is the reason why it came up in philosophy in the first place. So when I've heard people talk about logical positivism, it's usually, you know, especially amongst Christians, the logical positivists are the baddies. But if you look back at the context, what they were sort of moving against is what for us has sort of came in the wake of logical positivism in the 60s, which is sort of this postmodernism. You know, there's no reliable access to truth at all. And so those forces didn't just suddenly pop up in the 60s. They were alive and well, you know, in the 1800s as well. And so logical positivism is really an attempt to defend science against those who want to say, oh, everything is subjective. You can't, we can't really know anything about the external world. And so quite for obvious reasons, then someone like Bertrand Russell, who is, you know, is sort of famously very, very interested in you know, in both science itself and in logic and building things from the bottom up, basically sort of thought, all right, we'll take that challenge. We'll show you that, you know, science has a completely logical, airtight, waterproof, impenetrable foundation. And so that side of that debate was the side that was defending science against the people who were saying, we can't know anything. And so if you're a scientist then and you want to pick a side, obviously you pick a side with the people who say, look, science really does learn things about the world, and it does this in a way that is perfectly reliable, and you know, we do really get actual knowledge of the world, versus the people who want to say, you know, it's just, you know, they either want to psychologize what scientists are doing, or, you know, they're having fun spotting patterns, but there's nothing really there, or whatever, you know, affront, whatever attack on science was being made. And so I think through, if that's the two sides of the debate, then as a scientist, if you think science really does learn things about the world, and if why would you do it if you didn't think that, then obviously you're going to come down with those two options. You're going to come down on the side that says that, you know, you're going to hope and sort of think that hopefully these logic choppers, you know, the Bertrand Russells and the Alfred North Whiteheads and the AJ Ayres and all those people, that they're going to do for us basically what we hope the mathematicians do, which is clean up all the loose ends and give us a totally perfectly logically impenetrable foundation for all that we're doing here. So that's why I think it becomes very closely attached to science, especially you look in the 1920s and 30s, and I mentioned quantum mechanics before, but there's one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics is Niels Bohr, B-O-H-R, and part of the driving force of the way he approached quantum mechanics was, you know, there's got to be something in your, I want to say this as precisely as possible, because he, you know, I don't want to misrepresent. So he basically, the only bits of the theory that you can consider to be, you know, real and to be physics are the parts that are observable. And so if there's anything in your picture of the world as a physicist that isn't observable, then that has to go. You're putting details in that can't possibly be part of science. As he starts to formulate quantum mechanics, he has this picture of the quantum world, the world of the very small, where there's certain questions that you just aren't allowed to ask because they don't have answers in terms of experiments that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this has held back quantum mechanics for an awfully long period of time against the people who actually wanted to say that, actually, no, let's just do physics. Let's try to understand the world. The fact that we can or can't observe something is just a function of us as observers, you know, us as big people. You know, that's hardly a good criterion for science.
Mm.
Anyway, there's a massive long discussion there as well.
So it seems like, Luke, again, without getting too sidetracked, it seems like the blessing of quantum mechanics is that it has created a resurgence in the philosophy and science coming together. I think it was Werner Heisenberg who wrote a book called Physics and Philosophy. That's it.
Well, it's only very, well, as late as, okay, so there's a version of quantum mechanics which is perfectly deterministic. So famously, when you talk about quantum mechanics, it's all weird and fuzzy and there's no reality down at the bottom level.
Right.
Actually, no, there's a version of quantum mechanics which is perfectly deterministic. It's just particles get pushed around by waves. It's called wave. It's called pilot wave theory or Bohmian mechanics after David Bohm, who, you know, he realized that quantum mechanics could be formulated this way in the 50s. As you can read in great detail in Becker's book, Adam Becker's book, things then get really weird. Really weird that the scientific community, because they're under the sort of spell of Bohr and verificationism, says, all right, well, here's what's supposed to be a scientific theory, but it posits a whole bunch of things which aren't observable. So, for example, in Bohr's theory, you have particles pushed around by waves, but the only thing you can observe are the particles, so the waves are in principle unobservable.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to say, all right, well, then you're breaking the rules of science, so that can't be a real scientific theory. Whereas, like, of course it can. That's the way the world could be. But then Bohr is basically an outcast from the scientific community. The story gets weird here because he becomes the subject of investigation by the US government because of his ties to communism.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up somehow in Brazil without a passport and basically spends the rest of his days there, unable to attend conferences, writing papers, but not being able to promote his ideas. Then you get another interpretation of quantum mechanics called the many worlds interpretation, which I won't go into, but again, there's the person behind that doesn't find that it's Hugh Everett, but he finds the scientific community won't accept that either because there's unobservable things in it, and so he leaves to be involved in business. The people like, one of the most important physicists of the 20th century is a guy called John Bell, who proved some really important things about the foundations of quantum mechanics. But he had to do that in his spare time. He was a physicist, but he was a particle physicist. So he was analyzing the results of particle experiments. But all the stuff that he did, this amazing physics about the foundations of quantum mechanics, that he had to do in his spare time just because no one valued it, because quantum mechanics, we've got that, you know, there was a sort of the classic slogan is shut up and calculate. And so you don't go looking at the foundations. That's not science. That's just, you know, speculation and not verifiable and all that sort of stuff. So actually the move, the thought that, hey, actually this quantum mechanics, we should really start thinking about philosophy again, is remarkably late in the 20th century. It should have happened, like you said, with quantum mechanics in the 20s and 30s, but it only really starts to happen around the 80s and 90s.
Hmm.
With people who following John Bell, who's sort of 70s and 80s, people start to get interested in this thing, and then you have very, very smart people who start to bridge the gap, guys like David Albert, who do their PhDs, do their work in physics, but then turn to philosophy of science and are now world-famous experts in philosophy of science, and so can actually bridge that gap and start to talk between the two sides. Whereas you had a good, from the 20s to the 70s, the late 70s, you had a big period of time here where everyone, Bohr said we shouldn't ask these questions, so we don't ask these questions. So yeah, it does happen, it is happening, but it's happened awfully late.
So it seems like quantum mechanics has sort of really called into question sort of the unquestionable foundations of what we might call physicalism or empiricism, that the only kind of knowledge, the only kind of science is directly observable and testable. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, possibly. But even for someone like David Albert, it's not that, you know, there's other forms of knowledge other than science. It's that this idea that you have to be able to verify every single statement in your theory, that has taken us off the beaten path. So if you know your philosophy as well as a philosopher of science, you know, you know about verification, you know about logical positivism. So, you know, at least you recognize that scientism is a philosophical position and you might be prepared to defend it philosophically. Mm-hmm. The problem with quantum mechanics was that scientism became just an assumption that was so closely wedded to science that scientists couldn't tell the difference. Mm. They didn't realize they were doing philosophy when they assumed scientism.
Okay. Well, let's get into some very concrete definitions of people today that own the term, if you will, that what this idea of scientism looks like in practice, if you will, or in print. Now, to be clear, the people that we might say are guilty of scientism wouldn't be using the term and saying, I ascribe to scientism. They're not saying it in that way, correct?
Some of them do. So, I mean, we've got an example of someone who does, but a lot of them, they'll say something that's basically scientism without saying, because once you've named it, it's kind of obvious it's a philosophical position, and so you just want to pretend like this is science, and you're not defending the philosophical position of scientism. You're just saying that science is reliable and everything else is unreliable.
Okay. So I know this morning, this is interesting. This morning you're on Twitter. You know how Twitter goes. Somebody tweeted today or recently that Americans don't need Jesus. They just need a science education.
Yeah. Okay.
And I thought, well, there's a colloquial definition of scientism.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That has kind of taken the mind and the imagination of a lot of skeptics and non-Christians on social media. I get asked all the time, because I'm kind of defending my faith on Twitter a lot, if I can't test it, if I can't verify it, if I can't falsify it, if I can't repeat it, if I can't get it in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, then, as you said earlier, it's not knowledge. It's a meaningless faith because I can't test it. This seems to be the popular level understanding of scientism. Would you agree?
Yeah, this is how it becomes just like an assumption, barely even an assumption, just an attitude. You know, as a Christian, I would just say both. Right. Yes, I mean, people need Jesus. They better science education. I'm totally up for that as well. But it's especially weird when people say it like that, because, you know, way to make science look like a religion, which is not what we want to do either. I mean, even if you're a naturalist and an advocate of scientism, making science into, like, you know, its own religion seems like something you wouldn't want to do.
No.
But that is an interesting little example.
So let's get into the scientists who hold to some form of scientism. You give three examples in our profile. Why don't you begin with one of them, and we can go from there.
So one of the ones, the person who I immediately thought of when we were thinking about this was an Oxford, he's a physical chemist at Oxford, Peter Atkins. And so he wrote a book called On Being, which is a fantastically philosophical title, where he basically looks at what science says about the big questions about, you know, existence and life and all those sorts of things. And from the start, he says, so this is an example of, you know, science, scientism as just the assumption behind the scenes. So he says, and this is a quote, the scientific method can shed light on any and every concept, even those that have troubled humans since the first earliest stirrings of consciousness and continue to do so today. I consider there is nothing that it cannot illuminate because the scientific method has not yet encountered a barrier except the ones asserted to exist by those fearful of its illumination. My optimism leads me to suppose that the reach of its beam is boundless and in particular that it can replace or even conceivably confirm the myths that surround all the great questions of being.
Mm.
So this is, you notice that if you're a fan of science, this sounds like he's just defending science. There are people who, because of they are fearful of the illumination of science, that science is going to shine a light on what they believe. Those are the people who are trying to put barriers around science. But if you're not fearful of the truth, then science will just shine its light everywhere. And so that's without recognizing that that's pure philosophy. That's his his statement of scientism.
We want to be sure that this as we talk about scientism, we're not critiquing science as a whole, because this is the pushback I've gotten a lot. Well, if you are claiming people are believing in scientism, then you just don't like science. You're just afraid of science, as you say. We're not pushing back against good science. We are simply critiquing a particular strand of a philosophy of science, right?
Yeah, I myself am trying to do some good science from time to time. So, yeah, it's the difference between, like I said, even someone who believes in God could say that science is the most reliable form of knowledge that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's going that one step forward of saying it's the only reliable form of knowledge that we have, that you've now got yourself, that's a bigger claim. And it's a philosophical claim, and it's a philosophical claim that sort of shoots itself in the foot because it would need to be justified philosophically, but it has denied the idea that things can be justified in philosophically. Mm. So yeah, certainly one of the things about Atkins's book, if you read it, and it was a painful experience for me, but I did, is whenever he's just describing the science, he does fine. But whenever he tries to shine the light outside of the boundaries of science, suddenly things get really pretty awful, actually.
Mm.
So, for example, you know, he's describing life. When he's describing the biology of life and what actually happens when an organism dies, that's all fine.
Mm-hmm.
But when he wants to say something like, you know, people say that there's... You know, he wants to talk about the difference between, you know, minds and brains. He just equates the two without noticing that he's made that equation. That of course a mind is just a brain.
Mm.
Now that might be true, but you've got to do better than just assume that from the get-go. The other one is he wants to talk about the great question of why there is something rather than nothing, and as a part of that. He, in this book and in previous book, he's put forward his idea about a sort of a scientific picture about how something could come from nothing, in which he sort of imagined that there was a time when space-time, which we, around us, you know, space and time are continuous, there was a time when it was sort of like little dust particles flying around, combining and recombining in various ways. And then eventually they recombined into a smooth space-time that we see today, and that was stable, and that's how we got space and time at the beginning of time. Now, that is he wants to say, look, you know, that wasn't really taken up by the scientific community because it was speculative. No, literally, that the claims he makes are grammatically correct but completely meaningless. Not just... not just, you know, meaningless according to the verification principle, but literally meaningless. He wants he's trying to talk about, and he says this, we'll talk about the time before time. Well, that's a contradiction. You can't have little bits of space and time like dust particles flying around. What could that possibly mean? I mean, picture some dust particles flying around. They're flying around through space and time. How can space and time themselves start flying around?
Right.
I mean, what are they moving with respect to?
Uh-huh.
And so the fact that when he starts, as soon as he steps outside of what science can actually legitimately do, that immediately nonsense besets him, doesn't give him a clue, unfortunately.
Mm, mm. It seems, Luke, that I would say that might characterize Richard Dawkins or Lawrence Krauss or other notable scientists in their field who are adroit at addressing their specialty of interest, the biology or the cosmology or whatever branch of science that it is. But because I think culturally we ascribe so much authority epistemologically to science, that it seems like a lot of scientists, especially those in the popular mind who write popular books for lay audiences like myself, when they wax eloquently about any topic, they sort of get a free pass because they are a scientist. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, definitely. So another name that we looked at was Lawrence Krauss. So he had a 2012 book, A Universe from Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the assumption behind it. It's even more subtle and unstated than Atkins. But the assumption is just, look, there's this really old question that people have been asking for ages called why is there something rather than nothing? If there's anything to be said about this question that's valuable, it has to come from science. And if science can't answer that question directly, then science should change the question. So that was his approach to it. And you can see the scientism just lurking behind there.
Mm.
Either science can answer a question, or if it doesn't look like an answer to the question, just change the question.
Mm.
And so he says, oh, there's a really interesting quote here. So the question of why there is something rather than nothing, he says, while this is usually framed as a philosophical or religious question, it is first and foremost a question about the natural world. And so the appropriate place to try and resolve it first and foremost is science.
Mm.
So the interesting point is actually, we'll talk in a second about a third example, which is from the biologist Jerry Coyne. Coyne wrote a blog post. So Coyne read Krauss's book and wrote a blog post on his blog, whyevolutionistrue.com, basically saying that he didn't agree with Krauss's book.
Mm.
is the short story. Mm. It sounded like bait and switch. You know, you entice them in with the philosophical question and then you just give a purely scientific answer, but you haven't actually answered the question. And then in the comments, Krauss turned up. I assume they know each other, they must. And said, about the classical question, the why is there something rather than nothing, what Krauss says is that it, quote, may not be a fundamentally interesting question from a scientific perspective. And so because that question it's not an interesting question from a scientific perspective, I mean, read between the lines, science can't answer it, is what he's saying.
Mm.
Therefore, you know, let me continue the quote. That may be disappointing, but that doesn't mean it cannot be true. If it is a bait and switch, it's because science has done the switching. I may not be focusing on the classical question that has bothered philosophers, but I don't think I ever claim to. I nearly fell off my chair at that point. He says, there's a classical question, why is there something rather than nothing? And he says, I don't think I ever claim to answer that question. The title of the book, just a reminder, is A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. And so this is, it's,
mm-hmm,
if,
mm-hmm.
The assumption is if there's anything, here's a philosophical question, if there's anything interesting said that has to that can be said about that question. It must come from science, and if science can't quite answer the question, then we must redefine the question and bait and switch our way to a new question and then answer that question with science. And so that's all he does in the book. There's like a couple of pages of the bait and switch, and then the rest of it's just basically about science. But that's just the assumption.
We thank you for listening this week, and we hope you'll listen next Monday as we continue our discussion about scientism with Dr. Luke Barnes. On part two, Luke gives us more examples of scientism and how we as Christians can respond to those who challenge our faith with such an ideology. For Apologetics Profile, I'm Daniel Ray. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Who is my neighbor? Maybe they are atheists, Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, or Muslims. What do I say to them? How can I share my faith with them? Watchman.org has a wealth of resources available to equip you to better understand your non-Christian neighbors. Be sure to check out Watchman.org for more information. Watchman Fellowship offers the Profile Notebook, a comprehensive resource packed with over 500 pages of information on other religions, cults, New Age spirituality, and a host of other non-Christian movements and ideas. Each profile consists of 4 pages and offers comprehensive insights between the truth of the Christian faith and these other religions and belief systems. Be sure to check out some of the samples of the Profile Notebook at Watchman.org today. This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship, Incorporated, Arlington, Texas.